Pac-12 season. Thanks very much for coming. We have a really good lineup for the spring. If you haven't got one of these programs, they're at the table in the back, and you can pick them up on your way out. And also, or we could send it to you via email if you don't have it already. I'm really pleased today to introduce Paul Z. Bergen. He has been an artist in residence at the Archives of American Art. He's here as part of the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship Program. And this brings creative people into our midst and makes us think about our materials in new and different ways, which can be a great stretch for us, and sometimes, and also just thinking about ways that we've never thought about using our material before, it can be very exciting. And also reach an audience that we've never reached before. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for us, and we've been very pleased to have him in our midst. He works as a musician and sound artist, and he lives outside of Boston. Both his installations and musical performances make extensive use of spoken human voice recordings as musical elements alongside traditional and electronic instruments. He collects these voices from otherwise uninvolved individuals whom he records in various locations, from museums to street corners to rock clubs. And he puts it together in a really innovative way. So Halsey will tell you more, and yes. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liza. Thank you all for joining me for lunch. Well, I don't actually get lunch, but hopefully there's enough light for you guys to see your own lunch. I would like this to be informal, so if there's ever a moment where you have a burning question and would like to ask it, just feel free to jump in. I did create a presentation which makes it seem a little more formal than I perhaps want it to be, but I think that what I'll do is I'll start off talking a little bit about what I do in general. Liza gave a bit of a hint on that, and then give some examples of some of my previous projects, and then end up with what I have been doing here and what I hope to continue to do here in the future. So, this is a really exciting slide. So, as Liza mentioned, I work with spoken human voices in my artwork, and I sort of always come back to this sort of two-part phrase, which is that people say interesting things, and they say them in interesting ways, and you guys might disagree with that in certain instances. Hopefully not right now, but I really feel strongly that people do, people respond to questions in really interesting ways, and there's a lot of excitement to me in talking to different people, asking them different questions, exploring different topics, having people read different texts in different ways, and that is really what drives me in all of my work. So that's sort of what I come back to all the time. So in order to begin my work, I have to have raw material, and that raw material is spoken human voices. And so I spend a lot of time collecting. I go out and I interview people. I'll talk about this a little bit later, actually, about my different methods. But I collect voices from people in a lot of different ways, and then I try to represent those voices either collectively or individually back to people in the form of a musical work, in the form of an installation, a sound installation. And hopefully through that process, I somehow transform the voices, not into something that they aren't, but into something that sort of collectively they create, as a unit, sort of voices that would never have otherwise been brought together. Obviously the voices, the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings, and everything that go along with those. Hopefully a lot of this is going to make more sense once I give you guys some examples, so just bear with me for a few more slides. So as far as the methods that I use to collect voices, this is one of my tried and true methods. Can you guys see it? Am I standing directly in the way of somebody? Yes. Okay. So can I move off to the side here? I need my computer so I can advance the slides. Is that better? Okay. Yes. Sorry. I should have realized that earlier. So collecting voices. So this is what I call the bring your own voice booth. It is a very elegantly constructed plywood box that actually comes apart. It folds up. It goes on top of my little car, and I drive it around all over the place, and I sort of set it up on the street in this case. I've set it up in museums, other public places, and I use this to collect the voices. I ask people to sort of step inside with a list of questions about a particular topic that I'm interested in at the time, and they go in there, there's a microphone, and they do whatever they want, basically. So I've had lots of interesting people responding to my questions in there. As, of course, if you set it up on the street, you get a certain type of clientele. If you set it up in a museum, you get a different kind of clientele. And to me, it's really interesting to sort of explore lots of different types of people. And this has been a really effective method. I actually started trying to collect things. Well, I started initially with my family and my friends, and you know, I ran out of those pretty quickly. And then I started sort of going up to people and, like, you know, like a reporter, sticking the microphone in the face, and that didn't really work that well. Because I like to ask questions that sort of make people open up a little bit. And I found that the booth sort of gives people an enclosed sort of space to go inside and hopefully feel willing to express themselves in whatever way they choose, at least to feel comfortable. People who are claustrophobic do not do well in the booth, but other than that, people have had a pretty good time. So the booth is one way. I also do interviews, you know, direct one-on-one sort of interview situations where if I'm exploring a particular topic that requires lots of follow-up questions and whatnot, that tends to work better. And then I also do, I also create frameworks which people can participate on their own. So it might be an installation where there's a method for making your own recording and adding it to the mix, and I'll talk about this much more later. Or you know, a website that has a recording facility on it that people can make their own recordings and upload them to the piece sort of in real time. So, as the first slide said, I sort of consider myself a musician and a sound artist. You guys might know better than I do where the division between those is. I really don't know. I come at it from a music standpoint. I've played instruments with varying degrees of success from my childhood until now. And so I always sort of come at the art world from a musician's standpoint. So all of my work is, you know, has things like real instruments in it and whatnot, whereas, you know, a lot of really interesting sound art that other folks do is more environmental and whatnot. So I really try to create, you know, use the standard elements of music like melody and rhythm and things like that. So yeah, voices and instruments. I consider the spoken voice an instrument. And I consider collections of those voices to be sort of a collective instrument for me. When I'm performing, I actually sort of lay out, you know, hundreds of voices onto various electronic devices, which I sort of play as if it were an instrument. And you know, hitting one note triggers one, and hitting another note triggers something else. And that enables me to sort of treat the collective group of voices sort of as an instrument in and of itself. So when we speak every day to each other, when I'm speaking right now, I'm speaking in a way that might not sound musical because I'm generally sort of hitting the same pitch, but there are pitch variations, there are rhythms in the way I'm speaking, and there are therefore melodies, and you know, the speech, even though it's spoken, even when it's spoken, I think is an incredibly musical thing, and I try to sort of incorporate those natural rhythms that and melodies that go unnoticed in everyday sort of human existence into my pieces. So that's something that, you know, kind of drives you nuts listening to the same thing over and over and over and looping voices and all of that, but it's something I do quite a lot. So it's not just what people are saying, it's how they're saying it, and of course the way they say it. I think of the voice very much as a fingerprint that you know, is, I think, I don't know technically, but I think it's as unique as a fingerprint, and it really, but it's much more useful than a fingerprint in the sense that you can really, I think, tell a lot about a person, not only you know, by how they speak and by how they're speaking in a particular situation, and I like to try to sort of, you know, grab onto those emotions that they're expressing and use those in my pieces. So this is the technical part of the talk. The pie chart. I don't know if you've ever seen something like this before. It's really exciting. But what the point I'm attempting to make here with this pie chart is that when I make a recording of somebody's voice, there is so much that is included in that recording, in that audio recording of the voice that is not the semantic part. You know, you can write down in text, you can write down the words that somebody has said, and somebody can read that, and that's all fine and good, and that communicates the semantics. But if you listen to the voice and you listen to all the nuance and all the sort of the ways they're speaking and the rhythms and the melodies and sort of all of that stuff, I think you capture so much more about that person and about what they're trying to express and how they're trying to express it. I mean, you can get 30 people saying the same words and you'll get 30 different feelings that they leave you with. So this was my attempt at sort of saying, hey, the semantics are important, but they're only a small slice of what I'm interested in sort of mining when I look for my raw material. So now we get a bit of some examples. So starting off with some more performance music type examples, more of the music side of what I do, and then I'll get to the installation side. So Ocean Voices was a piece that that I've been working on. It's sort of an ongoing piece that is an initiative to collect voices from people around the world talking about the ocean. I personally love the ocean. I feel very connected to it, and it's something that I feel strongly about needs to, you know, continue to exist. and there's some issues with that in our current world. So I'm attempting to sort of bring the human element back into the notion of ocean conservation and whatnot. So I asked people all around the world, and I didn't get to travel all around the world because my budgets are art budgets. So very small. But you know, using the internet and using other technology, I was able to try to connect with people all around the world and ask them questions like, what does it feel like to be in the ocean? What would the world be like without an ocean? You know, tell us a story about a time you were on the ocean. And people donated, you know, I think I have something like 1,200 different recordings that were made. And the project's still live. It's not quite as active right now, but I'm trying to reinvigorate it a bit. But then I took all those voices and I wrote a piece of music called Ocean Voices as well. It was about a half an hour of music that incorporates, you know, not all the voices, but incorporates the ones that I felt sort of expressed what I wanted to, represent. And then it's a piece that I've performed. I premiered it at the California Academy of Sciences 2 years ago, and I've played it in D.C. last year at the Carnegie Institution for Science, is that what it's called? In any case, I thought I'd play you a few minutes of this just to give you an idea so I'm no longer completely abstractly babbling. So this is, it's a 30-minute piece, but this is maybe, I don't know, this is 4 or 5 minutes, I think, of samples of it, so I might adjust the audio, but we'll see how that goes.
That he who would spot the ocean first and call it out loud would be the master of the ocean communication, and the others would have to ask for his permission before they began. I remember the tension and the anticipation as our car drove on the winding road, knowing that at any moment a turn of the road could reveal the majestic immensity of the great blue. El mar, the ocean, the ocean. Take my head out the window and take in the bright air and relish in my good fortune. For 2 weeks, I will inhabit the world of oceans and be the king of the seas, my castle in the sand, chase little fish, play with the waves, and be as close to happiness as a person can be.
From the sky, maybe the beginning of this planet, when it was mostly volcanic action and activity and spewing heat into the air and causing condensation and that raining down, collecting over
probably
2 billion years into the planet that we know it is today.
I'm gonna say that ocean has always been on Earth since it, you know, since it was created, I guess.
Oxygen and hydrogen formed to make water. And so oxygen and hydrogen, hydrogen is very old. That comes from the very early parts of the universe when protons first formed.
I think the ocean came from
hydrogen.
God.
But to get oxygen, you have to
leave the ocean. And then
some process
land came after the ocean.
Just hydrogen and helium. I always want to be near the coast, and I like the feeling that I'm at the end of the, I'm at the edge.
Sometimes I can feel this vivid moves, often very gentle, but sometimes very mysterious, boisterous. Feels like it speaks to us, gushing with excitement, while mostly whispers through its veins.
So that's an example of more of a performance type piece. And now I'll talk a little bit about the installations that I do. So for the installations, I tend to work with creating systems rather than predetermined compositions. So I'll create a situation where the music is evolving over time. I use a lot of computers and things like that to compose music that will change constantly over time, that will pull different voices in, that will allow for people to contribute their own voices in certain cases in sort of real time to the installation. So whenever you go there, experience it, it's sort of a different thing, which is a bit nerve-wracking for me. But that's the control thing. So I wrestle with control quite a lot. Obviously, as an artist, you sort of want to control what you're doing. You want to have some kind of ability to create an experience that that you know, for other people. And for me, I think it's really important to. I'm a bit of a control freak, so I like to sort of give up control to other people, to the participants, to the other folks who are listening or experiencing the piece. So there's a sort of wrestling of control between me, between the participants, and finally between the computer, in many cases, which I like to say I allow it to improvise, just in the sense that I have random, you know, randomizations that sort of happen within within the piece. So the computer will make decisions as it goes, and those decisions are not bounded by my input directly. They're bounded by sort of, you know, edge conditions, but sort of anywhere in between they can, you know, the computer can make a decision and decide to go in different directions. So, you know, whenever I listen to one of my pieces, when it's live, you know, I never really know what I'm going to hear, and that's one of those things that's, like I said before, it's very nerve-wracking, but at the same time, I find that that moments are created that I would never have thought or, you know, been able to create on my own. And those, you know, there's the bad with the good, but for me, it's worth it to sort of allow this flexibility in order to potentially generate some of the good moments that that I wouldn't be able to do on my own. So control is kind of an important thing for me. So. Here's another example. This piece was at the Museum of Science in Boston. Actually, yeah, I guess we're doing a lot of that. Ocean Voices was performed there as well. But the Museum of Science asked me to do they commissioned me to do a piece on race. Have any of you guys seen there's a traveling exhibit called Race, Are We So Different? I think it's at the Natural History Museum now. Cool, so that was at the Museum of Science, or some iteration of that, and they asked me to create a piece to sort of complement that exhibit and take more of a artistic approach and more of a localized approach, because that traveling exhibit was not focused on Boston, of course, it was more of a national thing. So I created this piece called Voices Without Faces, Voices Without Races, and I interviewed people in the Boston area, asking them a number of questions, but these are some of the examples. Tell us about when you first became aware of race and how old you were. Tell a story in which you were privileged or disadvantaged by your skin color and or race. And what's your perspective on race in Greater Boston? So Boston's got a rich history of racial relations, good and bad, and there's a huge variety of different races and different ethnicities, backgrounds in the Boston, Greater Boston area. And my hope was to sort of try to represent, you know, a good cross-section of those. I wanted to collect personal experiences of people and sort of bring them together into a collective representation of this, you know, this big issue of race. I'm a white guy in America, so I don't have a lot of experience with some of the bad stuff that often goes along with race, and this was a really amazingly eye-opening experience for me, talking to a lot of people about these questions, and I found that a lot of people really, really enjoyed being allowed to talk about it, because it's quite often a really sort of taboo topic that, you know, you got to tiptoe around, and for good reason. It's something that you got to be really, you know, you got to be respectful, of course, but I found that a lot of people I talked to were very just sort of relieved, like, I'm being asked these questions, I'm allowed to express myself, I'm allowed to talk about what my experiences have been, whether they're good, bad, you know, ugly. There's some extremely ugly experiences that people have had, and there's, you know, there's good ones as well. And you know, I like to think that my work can affect people not only in the final product and what's sort of being shared with people, but also through the act of participating and through the act of becoming a part of it and the act of joining this collection of individuals in the creation of this new piece. So this was a really powerful piece for me personally. Just to learn so much. So the form that this took was it was a gallery inside the museum. There was six speakers sort of all around, and I'll actually show a video in a second, and then there was there were three video projections. The video projections were, there's a road in Massachusetts that sort of starts up at the New Hampshire border, it comes down through some blue-collar towns, through some very fancy white-collar towns, through Boston, right by the Museum of Science, and then goes all the way through South Boston down, and eventually goes all the way up to Cape Cod. So it's this really long road, and there's virtually every type of demographic and racial background on this road. So my idea was, this is sort of one road that we're all on, and that was sort of a thread that I used in this piece. And the reason I'm saying this is because the video was me driving that road many times with a video camera on the top and two video cameras at the side, and just sort of going for it. So the video specifically doesn't have any people in it, you know, voices without faces. You know, that's the hope, is that people will listen to the voices that are being played back, not without judging them by what the person looks like, because that's what race really is. It's people judging other people based on how they look. So I wanted to remove the face from it. So the video was really kind of boring on its own, but the hope was to sort of be mesmerizing and pull people towards the voices. So I will give you a short walkthrough of this in video.
We look at the softness edge of them, and that is personal racism.
They have no idea what it's like to be me.
We all got a mouth, a voice, you know, a heart.
Gaining the kind of control.
You know,
gaining
it's not about kind of race,
control.
It's about gaining the
kind of control. Assume that we were gang-related.
My expectation in life is that people will like me and respect me and treat me fairly.
They don't want you here. They don't like you. They don't want you here. They don't like you.
Problem at all.
So now here we are here. I have actually been doing things for the 2 months that I've been on this fellowship, and I just wanted to sort of give a little bit of an overview of what on earth that has been. So it turns out that Smithsonian has a lot of voices. There's a lot of voices and archives all over the place, and that is very exciting to me. And yes, lots and lots of voices. There's more than I even imagined, and probably more than I'm even aware of now. But for me, the really exciting proposition of doing something with some of the voices that are here at the Smithsonian is that they, you know, I mean, quote unquote, old voices, not necessarily that they're actually old. They could have been recorded very recently, but they're voices that were recorded for other purposes by somebody else and not for my purposes. So what I've always done in the past is record, you know, as I explained, you know, I use that plywood box or interview people or whatever, and I always sort of make the recordings myself for my own work. And in this case, it's a very different situation because there's this whole sort of massive archive of voices that were made for a whole variety of different reasons, and you know, they exist over 50 plus years of time, and that's an amazing resource to me and something that's very exciting. So I've really had fun sort of getting into that and sort of taking this new approach to my own work. So that's been a real change and something that I've been very appreciative of with this opportunity. So there were three things that I did when I was here. One, sort of identify what exists. I'll get into each of these in more detail. And then decide what I want to use of what does exist. And then figure out what to do with it all. So this is, again, I'm getting very technical here. But identify what exists. You know, this really is not the very exciting part. This is going around and talking to all the different units. I'm learning terminology, so I've learned the unit terminology. I've learned a lot of acronyms, and I've learned a lot of other exciting things about Smithsonian and what it's about and how one can potentially navigate. I'm definitely not expert yet, but going around talking to different people, talking to archivists, talking to curators, there's a lot. There's sort of official archives, and then there's sort of unofficial archives as well. Quite often, curators will have studio visit recordings and things of that nature that are sort of in their personal collections that are not officially archived, but are nonetheless, to me, actually in some ways more interesting, that they're more sort of informal and whatnot. So decide what I want to use. I, after doing a lot of research as far as what actually exists, I decided that I wanted to really focus on artists' voices. I think that artists can be, well, first of all, there are a lot of them in the collections, especially here in this building, of course. But I find, you know, the artists quite often have a lot of interesting things to say. They have a lot of different perspectives. They can often capture really in an interesting way the sort of zeitgeist of different eras and different times, because there are, you know, like I said, 50 plus years of recordings. It's the artists' voices were very intriguing to me. I wanted to get as much variety as I possibly could, different, obviously within the artist group. And to me, artist means, sort of broadly speaking, sort of anybody who's creatively sort of, I don't know if I want to say employed, but whose life is a creative endeavor. So that would be, you know, craftspeople from like the folkways festivals and that kind of thing, and musicians as well. So there's some great collections of musician voices as well. So a lot of variety, both sort of in different times and different types of people. And I want to use sort of big chunks of these voices, not just tiny selected clips. So the idea would be to sort of amass a database of these voices and then, as I referred to before, let the computer sort of improvise and take little pieces of different voices out at different times based on, you know, my sort of overall direction. So number three, figure out what to do with it all. And I'm going to go through like five things here, and then they'll start to make more sense once I get to the next slide. So I wanted to bring the archives outside, like literally outside, but not necessarily physically. Don't worry, archivists of you in here. I'm not going to actually do that, but basically make them accessible to people sort of out in the public instead of solely in here. I wanted to sort of fill the spaces between the buildings. There are all these really, you know, there's all these archives that exist at the different units, at the different museums, and they're all physically located in a certain spot. And I thought it would be really interesting to sort of try to create a continuous experience for people who are visiting the Smithsonian to not just have one museum and then the next and then the next, to sort of have a more continuous experience sort of wandering between the buildings. I wanted to, in that same regard, sort of connect the museums / units together, encourage exploration and participation, all within the context of a new work of art. So how am I going to do that? That's still very significantly to be determined, but this will hopefully explain some of it. So here, you probably recognize this, you know, okay. So these are the museums. Oh, did that even show at all? Did you guys see anything change? Okay, so you can see the museums. I think there's seven or so, the different buildings, the different museum buildings. I didn't actually put this building on because it's not a publicly, it's not sort of a publicly accessible museum exhibit place. So basically what I want to do is create a continuous layer of audio that sits on top of this, basically most of this map, and that is accessible to people in a location-sensitive way. So as people wander around and they're in different locations, they will hear different things. And that is where technology and smartphones come into play. This is not something where I put speakers, you know, in the trees and in other places that would be very expensive and highly obtrusive. So, so the idea is basically to, like I said, create this continuous layer of audio on top of the mall and extending all the way up to where we are now with Sam and MPG. So these circles are meant to represent sort of different regions of music. So I will compose a piece of music that is, you know, influenced by the physical surroundings here and by the voices that I've collected, and I will place virtually, of course, place different sections of music in different locations. And this is purely this is just trying to give you a representation of what it's going to be. I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, but each of the circles, think of each of the circles as like a different, maybe a different track on your like mixing board. If you guys use GarageBand or anything, if you have the drum track and you can raise and lower that, you have the guitar track and you can raise and lower the volume of that, and you can change the way the different parts of the music interact. That's not exactly what this is, but that's a good way of thinking about it. So if you walk from one of these circles to another of the circles, you will hear, you know, the audio from the first one. You're in here, you'll only hear the audio from this circle, and then as you get to here, you'll start to hear a mixture of the audio in here and in here, and then you'll gradually get to a spot where there's only audio from this particular circle. So there'll be lots of overlapping areas, and again, I don't know anything about the specifics at this point, but the idea is to create a composition that is that exists spatially so that people can explore and hear different parts of it depending on how they walk. So that's kind of the first layer. And then on top of that, there will be a layer of these little dots. And these little dots are representing the artist's voices. So the voices that I find in the archives, the recordings that I find, I can take and I can put them out there, put them out in the real world, in different locations. I can group them in different ways. I don't know how I'm going to group them right now. I could do it sort of chronologically, like the 60s are over there, and then the 70s and these. I could group them by, you know, media. I could group them by male, female. I mean, there's so many different ways that I could do this, and I'm thinking about lots of different ways, but it'll come down to a lot of experimentation, sort of feeling, seeing what feels right. So. But basically, the idea is to sort of take these recordings that are in the archives now and put them out there so they exist in the physical world, in real space. So you have to actually go to a particular spot to hear that. So people would be able to wander, and as they ran into these dots here, they would start to hear that particular voice. And not only would there be the artist's voices, that's sort of what the system would be seeded with, if you will. It would begin that way, but then people will be able to make their own commentary as well. So using the same, you know, smartphone that they have that they're listening to. They basically can press a record button. I just heard this artist talking about blah, 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 blah. I thought it was really interesting. It reminds me of when I was, you know, a kid in the 70s and I used a finger paint. I have no idea. I'm just making stuff up. But the point being that people in the present day will be able to sort of have this conversation, if you will, with other people who have experienced the piece and with these voices that that are, you know, that were recorded in the past and are now sort of, you know, I use the word reanimated. I don't know. I had to come up with something for the title of this talk, but I don't know if they're actually reanimated or if they're something else. But the point being that that people can dive into this sort of ocean of audio that's location sensitive and hear these voices swimming around in that, and then also put their own voice in, kind of tag the landscape, if you will, with their own experiences and their own personal feelings about it. All voices would be immediately available. So in other words, you submit it, and then you stand in the same place, and you hear your voice in there right away. So that, of course, you know, makes some people nervous. but getting that sort of payback and that sort of installation of trust in the participant is extremely important to me. So that's the idea for what my research will sort of ultimately result in. And you know, I'm at the early stages of it. I'm still talking to lots of people at the different units and trying to figure out the best way to sort of navigate all the internal stuff that has to be navigated to do things, but it's been great. There've been a lot of very positive, lots of enthusiasm and whatnot. So I think the pan-institutional projects are particularly complicated. So I think I should probably, well, I could do one of two things. I could either just go to questions, or I could show you a quick video about a piece that I did that was similar to what I'm talking about doing here called Scapes. And I don't know, maybe we should see if there are questions. If there are no questions, then I will play this or we can all leave. Are there any questions? Yes.
I have two technical questions. One is, in the first pieces that you showed us, were the musical soundtracks, were those in some way derived from the voices, or were the voices sort of set to music?
The music always, for me, always comes after the voices. So after I collect all the voices, after I listen to them, after I absorb them, after I sort of feel what they're all about, then I create the music. And sometimes there's very direct relationships where I will sort of, the key of a piece will be based on a certain prominent recording that I'm going to use that sort of is speaking in relatively in that key. But other times it's more of an abstract sort of, I got this general feeling from the recordings and I wanted to create music that sort of supported that that sort of collective feeling of the voices that I've sort of amassed. So it's always voices first. I never have music and then go out to find the voices to sort of fit into the music or just slap them in there. It's always kind of starts with the voices, but it's not always. It's sometimes a bit obtuse in how I actually end up getting there. But does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Was there another question?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in the Smithsonian project, which seems really interesting, maybe this is clear to other people, but I'm not totally clear on how exactly, like if I were walking through the mall, how would I hear, would I listen to the voice on my phone? Is that...
Yeah, sorry if that probably wasn't very clear. Yeah, there's an app.
Oh, okay.
There
sorry.
Will be an app that is for this. There have been apps that I've created for other projects. You have a big listen button, you press listen, and then you walk.
Okay.
And you hopefully don't look at your phone anymore. You kind of walk around, you see what's around you. It's very important to me to have people not jumping into their phones. You know, the technology is supposed to be an enabling thing, but not what it is. So, you know, press listen, put it in your pocket, then just go around and look and observe and then react to what you're seeing and whatnot. And there's so much to react to on the mall. I'm not from here, so it's, you know, you walk out there and you're like, wow, the monument is so big. So I was sort of shocked by a lot of those, so great. Any other? Yes.
I actually saw
I feel like I've heard that phrase, but I didn't know that it was a musical group.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
They mixed recorded voices with music and have the similar process actually.
Cool.
Like said, always work with voices first, but that was the first time I had ever heard of that type of movement. And so I was just curious in the art world, or if you know any other artists that are working.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am not an art historian at all, but it's certainly something that's been done a lot. I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, Steve Reich did some amazing pieces back in the 60s where he took voices and looped them and had all this really crazy stuff happening with sort of repetitively looped pieces of speech. And, you know, John Cage did a lot of that. David Byrne and Brian Eno have done some of that stuff together and on their own. So I'm sure there's lots of other examples of it. So that's definitely, there's sort of a long history of it. I think it goes, you know, it coincides to a large degree with the technology that enabled it to happen. You know, before tape recorders and that kind of thing, it was, you know, you couldn't do it, you know. But as soon as technology started coming out that enabled these kinds of things, people used them in all different ways. So yeah, there's a lot of them. I'll have to check out the Happiness Project. That sounds really cool. I'll definitely check it out. Yes.
I'm just curious, after you described your method for doing the music after, so how will the sort of spontaneous voices gathered from participants then get worked into whatever musical soundtrack you create?
Right. Well, that's a good question. In certain situations, you know, I answered Emily's question by saying the voices always come first, and they do, except in situations where it starts without any voices. So there are situations where a piece will start with nothing and then people will have to participate. And then I tend to update the music a bit. And the music usually comes from the physical surroundings. Like, you know, I've done things related to sort of the topography of spaces, of landscapes and whatnot, and the like. So you're right that it's not, when there aren't any voices, it's hard for the music to be inspired by the voices. In the case of the Smithsonian Project, obviously all the artist voices would be the ones that are in there, and those would be inspirational to create the music in the first place. I do tend to revisit things and sort of adjust as things go. So I definitely listen to all the voices that I get an email, you know, I get a new voice, you know, so I can listen to that and then sort of see where it is and think about potentially changing it. But, you know, especially in something that's so sort of such a big area as what I'd be doing down here, it's not like somebody makes a voice recording and then I write a little piece of music that goes right there with that. It's much more of sort of a broad kind of, you know, collective representation. So things change on a slower basis. But yeah, it was a good question. So I think there was another, No. No. All right. So the question is, yes. Yes. Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and the simple answer is no, I do not. I do score the you know, the notes and the parts for like the string section that you saw in the Ocean Voices piece, you know, those, that's all scored. I have only ever performed my music myself, so I've never had the need to write down a representation of what voices go where, because I kind of know where they go because I wrote them, but it's really interesting to think about, because I don't have any idea how I would actually do that, and it would be a challenge. But it's you know, there's so many interesting sort of alternative sort of scoring mechanisms that people use, and there's probably some good ones for speech that I don't even know about. But yeah, that's an interesting way of going about it. I usually kind of lay the voices out on my instrument in a way that makes sense to me as far as how the song progresses. So they're grouped together in the Ocean Voices piece. There are a section where kids were talking about, you know, what would the world be like without oceans? So I have a lot of kids' voices sort of into like a 3-octave range on my keyboardy thing that I can sort of play around with. And you know, it's not exactly the same every time. There's flexibility in that, partially because I can't ever remember what exactly should happen, but also because I think it's kind of fun to have that that improvisational sort of aspect. So, yes, I think we are. Well, it is 12:53. So we have another question. Yes.
When you're done with your mall app, how will we find it? Will it be a Smithsonian app? Will it be under your name?
That is a good question. I mean, this will be, if it happens, it will be a Smithsonian commissioned thing. So I don't know. You know, I don't know who I don't know actually who would release the app. We obviously would have to, you know, for all of my work, it's like you can't see it. So there's always this challenge to sort of how to promote it, how to let people know that it exists. So hopefully in the different museums there would be some kind of signage and whatnot. But as far as how it was released, I would guess that I could see it going both ways, and I'd kind of probably prefer it to be grouped with my other apps, which are art. You know, they're portals into artworks rather than the Smithsonian apps, which are wonderful, but they're portals into educational experiences. So that would be what I would prefer, but you know, we'll see how that goes. Another question,
so
yes.
I was just curious if you have some sense of a timeline for how long would a project like this take?
From my perspective, for me to create it, it does. I think the timeline is going to be determined more by internal logistics and, well, there's copyright things too, yeah, for sure. So all of the sort of internal logistical kind of things, I think, are probably going to be the things that take the longest time. As far as I go, I mean, if I were to start today and sort of really doing this, you know, I would need, you know, half a year or something to really get into everything and really know what's going on. If there was, you know, pressure to do it quicker, I probably could. But realistically speaking, I think spring of 2013 would be the first time it could happen, just because it might be ready for the winter, but, you know. I mean, I'm from Boston, so it's not that cold to walk outside around here, especially like the last few days. It's been crazy. But it's an outdoor thing, so I would like it to be relatively pleasant for people to experience. And I don't know how long it would last either. That's something that I've thought about. Is, to me, it's extremely interesting to sort of, with this evolving layer of participation from people, if it's a piece that can last for several years, then you start getting this sort of more interesting ways of listening to the participation. You know, you can hear what people were talking about, you know, last year versus this year and whatnot, which is kind of fascinating to me, to have this layering of history sort of all in one spot. So that's kind of fun. One more, two more, yes.
How do we find the other apps that you worked on? And then the other question is, do you build the apps or do you work with a company that builds apps?
Okay, the first question is, where do you find the apps? And you can search on the App Store or the Android Market searching for Halsey will do it, Halsey. My company, they force you to have a company name when you like do apps, so my company name is Halsey Solutions, which has got a long dorky history and no questions about that, but yes, Halsey Solutions will kind of bring up all of the apps that are available. A lot, like there's an Ocean Voices app and there's the Scapes, and you know, most of them are location specific, so if you can use them wherever you are, but they will sort of warn you, you're not actually where you're supposed to be, we're going to play you a sample of the audio instead of actually getting you giving you the location based experience, but yeah, that would be great. Check them out. So yeah, Android and iOS. I try to do everything on both platforms. More is on iOS than Android, but I'm doing them both at this point. And as far as who builds the stuff, I do not really do much of the super technical work. I'm fairly technical for being an artist and being a musician, but I'm not, you know, the people I work with laugh at my technical abilities because they're pretty, pretty low. I project manage everything, you know, very tightly, and I determine what all the characteristics of the apps are going to be. And of course, I determine what they look like, but, and what, you know, and how they generate the audio, of course. But as far as the actual coding and actually building the stuff, I have friends who I'm probably forever indebted to for all of their efforts to for very little pay to actually create these apps. Of course, you know, the first one's a big job, and then the second one becomes a little less because you can reuse a lot of the stuff that you've used before from a technology standpoint. You know, each experience, each artwork is a different musical experience and different voices and all of that, but the technology can overlap a lot, which is, I mean, thank God, you know. You know, the amount of effort for the first project was just so much, but yeah, there's some great software developers out there who are very nice with their time, so I'm indebted. One more question? No more questions. Thank you guys, I really appreciate it. Thank you for spending your lunch. Oh, I've got lots of exciting, one piece of exciting paraphernalia, which is the brochure from this show, so I can kind of actually pass those around if you guys have any interest. And I think my contact info is in there as well.